Well, when we first talked about my return here, a lot of different topics came up as possible topics for discussion, and we honed in on one, which is has been a favorite of mine for about a year now, just kind of looking at the various nuances of this particular teaching of the Buddha. And it has to do with attachment and non-attachment, understanding the Buddha's teaching on attachment and non-attachment, because really it's a key player in all this process that we talk about in terms of waking up. You know, most of us, as whether you're new to the practice or have been with it for some time, the objective really for all of us is to do what needs to be done to overcome the suffering in our lives, to overcome the difficulties in our lives. And so we thought it would be nice to look at this activity of the mind that is the main culprit in all of this, the experience of attachment. And Buddha talks about this, the Pali word for it is upadana. He talks about it in a number of teachings. I think it's interesting that it gets some play right in the very first teaching, where in the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, right in the first Noble Truth, one of the ways that he says that, the ways that he's defining suffering, and one of the forms that it takes is attachment or clinging to the body and the mind. And he gives a more elaborate explanation of this as the five aggregates of clinging. And so it plays, you know, this is the first thing that came out of his mouth after his awakening, and the first time that he offers some teaching. So I don't know about you, but that always gets my attention. You know, it's like, wow, what'd he say? And this is one of the first things that he points to. And you could even say that it's in the second noble truth in another sense, because the second noble truth is about the craving that is rooted in ignorance. And this craving has a tendency to escalate in the unawakened mind, and that escalation is what we call upadana, or clinging, this attachment to what's going on with the body and the mind. And then it plays really big in the teaching on dependent origination, which you may have touched on in your various classes, where this is something that happened on the night of the Buddha's enlightenment, where he sort of poses the question of why do we suffer, and he sees a progression taking place, a very complex teaching. But the kernel of it really is that when there we have experiences at a sensory level, those experiences have a certain amount of pleasure and pain associated with them. The not seeing of that moves the mind in the direction of sort of craving for more pleasure and trying to avoid the pain. And then again, that tendency of the unawakened mind escalates. And before you know it, we find ourselves in states of more perverse clinging and suffering as a result of that. So there's a lot of different ways that he comes at it in the teachings, but one particular teaching that I love is where he talks about the experience of upadana as taking four different forms. And so that's why we sort of picked it too, because we have four classes together and we can zero in on one of these each night. But these four forms in brief are there's clinging or attachment to sensuality, clinging or attachment to what's called precepts and practices and sort of just ways that we become compulsive about our lives, but also cling to undeveloped ideas about the practice itself. And this is one of the biggest obstacles. So I hope you'll come next week, because it's a biggie to wake up to the way that we may be misinterpreting what the meditation practice is, what it's about, and what it's geared towards. And this can be a huge obstacle in practice. The third one has to do with attachment to views. Opinions and views is often put out as, but it's a little more complex than that. It's just the tendency in the mind to create fixed positions. You may have seen this once or twice in your own mind or other people's, but it's a high tendency in the unawakened mind to determine that it's this way, and defy anybody to tell us anything different than that. You know, and it's a huge source of suffering. I mean, this is the stuff that wars are made out of. You know, this is the stuff that has to do with all kinds of religious and political antagonism. So there's a lot in that for us to see. Because often the Buddhist teachings are very misunderstood on this account. You know, sometimes it can sound like he doesn't have to do anything about what's going on. So hopefully we can look at some of that, those concerns around that. And the last one is attachment to or clinging to self. And this is where we can tend to lose people and gloss over. You know? But the idea here, which sounds really weird when you put it out there, but when you understand what he's saying is so profound and so enormously helpful. But basically he's saying that, you know, that while we might have a sense, a very real sense, that there's somebody in here who's running the show, you know, that we're kind of the master of the universe, you know, that it's just not that way. And this is enormously liberating when we uncover the truth of that, because it is particularly attachment to self, when as long as that's rooted in our way of reacting or responding to life, it's the basis for attachment. You know, everything becomes something to want and something to get away from this vantage point of me. You know, you got that in there rock solid, then it's a setup. It's a setup for all kinds of craving and clinging and suffering down the road. So we'll try to get at that. And again, as I said, I think it's one of these teachings that can sound weird, but I hope we can unpack it in a way that you'll see it's actually not that hard to see and not that hard to overcome in the process of through our meditation. So let's just start, look at this first one, the clinging to sensuality. And, you know, most people will recognize this one at the get-go. It has to do with clinging to anything that has to do with the five physical senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and also the sixth sense in Buddhism, which is thinking and feeling. So it's not just, it covers everything, everything that we experience. This is our experience, the body and mind. And there's a way of attaching or relating to these so as to constantly be seeking gratification through this experience. And that's sort of like a tag. It's an add-on. You can have the experience without the clinging is what he's trying to get to. So, you know, if you understand what he's pointing to here, I think it's not just delicious foods and it's not just the experience of being comfortable. But it is there's clinging in a sense realm to the things that the mind is doing, you know. So that the way that this plays out is, you know, this incessant tendency on the part of most of us to just constantly be problem solving, you know. And watch the mind; it's fascinating to see it. If there aren't any problems, it'll come up with something, you know, just so that it can cling to ideas and thoughts about things like this. Or just you might notice a tendency in your meditation, maybe even tonight. Who knows? You know, dealing with difficult people, dealing with difficult situations in our lives, and the mind just keeps mulling it over and thinking about things. Or one of the big ones is just you know, incessantly thinking about ourselves, you know, and incessantly thinking about where we're going and what our life's all about and where it's all, you know, what it's all about. And certain amount of this, I certainly doesn't want to put this down. There's a way to constructively mull over things without it tipping over into this state of suffering around it all. So just on very subtle levels, what we're saying here is that the mind is seeking sensory gratification or sensory gratification or sensory satisfaction in the experiences of the body and mind from one moment to the next, and it grasps and clings to these. So, you know, I don't know about you, but I mean, to me, it has to be said that at one level, you can't fault the mind for this. It's completely understandable. I mean, look at our experience as human beings. You know, there are so many wonderful sights and sounds and smells and flavors and thoughts to think and dreams and imaginings and fantasies and all of this. You know, it's delicious, you know, especially if you're a greedy type. You love this stuff. You know? The mind just can't get enough of all the possible pleasure that's out there. But actually, this also includes the clinging to difficulties, which is an interesting twist on it, which we also do, you know. The mind can mull over vendettas and difficulties just as much as the things that it wants. So, you know, whether it's clinging to things that are going on with the body or, you know, the idea of figuring things out and sorting things out with the mind, you know, the clinging can be quite strong, quite voracious. But the difficulty here is that it's so great. The habit to grasp at sensory experience is so great that most of the time, at least in the unawakened state, we don't even know we're doing it. You know, it seems to be life. It seems to be the way it's supposed to be. And so we don't even know that we're doing it. And so when that's the situation, then you can't adequately stand back and question whether this impulse to constantly be grabbing and clinging is serving us in any way. You know, that to be able to see that requires a no small amount of non-attachment. You know, to be able to see if attachment serves. And so you see the dilemma. You know, one has to cultivate a certain amount of non-attachment to be able to get some inklings into what he's even saying here. And I think one of the things that I've experienced a lot is that we don't realize the pain of being at the mercy of all of this. And for myself, I mean, this is just true for me in my practice, and maybe you find it true for yourself as well, that I think probably the most powerful aspect of change that has taken place for me through meditation has been in very subtle and sometimes even indirect ways where this mind is beginning to get it that I'm really suffering because I want something so bad or don't want it. You know, that movement of the mind. And you sort of have to come in the back door on that sometimes. It may not be so obvious, but sometimes it's just the sheer determination to sit through the force of karmic patterns and habits. And even if it's not being taken in fully consciously, at some profound level, the mind is getting it that this is painful. You know, I just want to be here with things as they are instead of always having to grab and push away. You know, for myself, this was enormously powerful in my practice when I began to see that. I was like, oh, stop it. Stop. And just to hold the pain of that stop it, you know, that's the experience out of which the change begins to happen, the relinquishing, the letting go. But I think probably the most important thing, reason why we need to see this is that when we don't, we fail to recognize that the happiness that we are tied up in, the quest for happiness through the sensory realm, is not the highest happiness. And this is one of the places where the Buddha stands alone, I think. In the sutta that we covered the last time I was here, the Satipatthana Sutta, the Foundations of Mindfulness, you may recall, I'm sure many of you are quite familiar with it, the second foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of feeling, mindfulness of the experience of pleasure and pain and neither. And in this teaching, he makes a very important distinction between what he calls worldly happiness and unworldly happiness, or worldly pleasure and unworldly pleasure. And to me, I mean, one of the monks says, you know, the Buddha is really the ultimate pleasure seeker because he's trying to get us to see that the world, the happiness that's associated with the cheesecake and all the thoughts and the ideas, you know, is not the highest happiness. And this is for us to see, it's not to be believed, but to begin to realize and experience for ourselves that the unworldly happiness is this self-same, the happiness of non-attachment, the happiness of renunciation, the happiness that comes with being able to hold things with kindness and compassion and harmlessness. You know, these are the states that, you know, I like to call them what's optimally human. You know, humans at their very best. No non-attachment. They know renunciation. They know kindness. They know harmlessness. They know compassion. You know, and that's, whether we realize it or not, that's what our practice is all about. You know, right view and right thought actually are the experience of replacing greed, hatred, and delusion with renunciation, harmlessness, and kindness. So that's the process that takes place. That's the very process of waking up. So he says that there's a verse that I like. It says there is pleasure when a sore is scratched, but to be without sores is more pleasurable still. Just so there are pleasures in worldly desires, but to be without worldly desires is more pleasurable still. Yeah? So this is what he's getting at in this kind of teaching. And so a lot of practice involves uncovering this for ourselves. You know, it's not enough to sit here and think, oh, that sounds right. You know, I agree with that. I believe that. Yeah. You know, but the Buddha repeatedly says, don't believe it. See it for yourself. And observe your own experience and see if, in fact, this holds up. You know, and then, I mean, you can watch, you can see it in all kinds of silly things. I was watching just last week when I was at the Barry Center, and there was, somebody had put out a bowl of Hershey Kisses. You know, mm-hmm. And it was just and it was interesting to see how long that last Hershey Kiss stayed there. And maybe it was people not wanting to be seen to be the one that took it. But I like to think that it was everybody just practicing with this. It's, you know, I would be happier if you had it. That's what we're pointing to here. You know, that experience, and it's not self-effacing. It can be false, but let's move it in the direction of it not being false. That one has actually come to see for oneself that that feels so great. It feels so much better than getting it for myself and gratifying myself. Yeah. So this is what he's pointing to. It's not so far out. So Valerie introduced me. She mentioned that I'm associated with the lineage of Ajahn Chah, the Thai forest tradition. And he's a wonderful teacher from the last century in Thailand. Has since passed away, but he's got such a simple teaching, and he just nails some of this stuff in the most simple ways. And this is what he says about it. He says that the real practice takes place when the mind meets sense objects. Right there. That's kind of where the rubber meets the road. And, you know, part of our effort in practice is to become keenly aware of that. That's not so easy to do, admittedly. But he's saying that the pull and the lure of sense objects is really great. And he uses this image. He says that it's like the meat that keeps getting stuck in your teeth every time you eat it, you know, and it hurts and it gets stuck every time, and you have to pick it out. But that doesn't stop you from eating it. You know, it's like that. And maybe that image is not so good among current-day Buddhists, there's so many vegetarians. But so think of it as like the popcorn or something, you know, where, you know, it always gets stuck. It gets in your throat, it gets in the back of your throat, it gets in your teeth, your gums bleed, and you know, yet we can't stop doing it, you know. It's that kind of thing. So he says this. He says, we have to notice the pain of grabbing hold of everything that we meet, and we have to become fed up with it. And I think that language is important, you know, because he's pointing to one of the teachings of the Buddha, which is it's a word that's often mistranslated or misunderstood. You have to get it at a feeling level, but the word is nibbida, N-I-B-B-I-D-A, and it's usually translated as disenchantment, but sometimes disgust. And he said that's the experience of being fed up with grabbing hold of everything that we come into contact with. You know, and at first glance, that might not sound real attractive. You know, nobody wants to walk around being fed up and disgusted all the time, you know. But it's pointing to a quality of heart that is very informed through wisdom, through having seen, through direct experience, through having seen the pain and the harm of being so preoccupied with the sense realm, that it's kind of like a force field starts to develop around things. You know, as you experience, and I'm sure you have, you know, maybe not at the level that we're talking about, but maybe yes. You know, we get these inklings, and we have these moments where we've learned that this particular path is the harmful path, and we don't go there. And it's almost like, you know, sometimes you can feel like somebody, you're about to even do it, and somebody throws the switch, and you don't go that way, you know. That experience is this experience of nibbida. The mind literally turns away. It ceases to want in the old ways. It's found something better. It's found non-attachment. It's found renunciation, and it likes it better. You know? So that's how one of the ways. I mean, if you look for measures of your progress in practice, you know. This is one of the things you can look for. Is that happening? Are you beginning to see that experience of having thrown the switch in the tracks? So, you know, at this point, I don't know, when I was reflecting on it, I came to this place where I thought, well, you know, let's be honest here, though. You know, this is just not our usual mode, and we have to be real about this. Our usual mode is not is to be mesmerized and enchanted with it all, and so that seems to point to the fact that we just get blindsided by sensuality, by the sense realm, and it's like I've experienced it once, almost like falling asleep. You know, you wake up long after you've been lost in something for a long time. And you go, well, what happened? You know, how did it happen? It's usually after everything's all over that we begin to see that we've been so caught up. And it is very much like falling asleep, you know, because we don't know, we didn't see it happen, and we don't know where we've been while we're caught, you know. And besides, I think it's while we're being honest, I feel like it has to be said that we may not have a whole lot of motivation to stop doing this, you know, to stop being caught up in this way. I know for myself, I used to watch, and certainly in the early years of my practice, I'm glad to say it's subsided somewhat now, but oh man, I could fantasize with the best of them, you know. You sit on a 3-month retreat and you get caught in a fantasy mode. It's like it's grueling, you know. Every sitting is just going on about things you want and don't have, you know, or some a person that you want to be with and aren't with, or all that kind of stuff, you know, and just lost in imaginings. Or when I would get caught in my $27 million lottery fantasy, you know, when I'm in it, you can't tell me that I'm not having fun. You know, it's like, this is delicious, this is so much fun, you know, throwing all the money around and giving everybody what they want and what they need, and, you know, just what would it be like to have that kind of money and spend it, you know, that kind of thing. It has this really delicious side to it, you know, whether it's that or some delicious, beautiful sight or sound or taste or whatever, you know. So we have to admit that. And I think it's interesting that Ajahn Chah clearly admits this as well. He says, by all means, see the pleasure that's associated with grabbing hold of sensuality. By all means, see it. So he says, see the advantages. See what that feels like. And then, but he says, but then also you have to see the disadvantages. And this is where we forget, we kind of lose it, you know. So, you know, you have this sense of, yes, it's very pleasant to be caught up in this fantasy. You know, I'm really enjoying myself. But then when I snap out of it, I become aware that it's also very unpleasant to have been there. Or like a lot of people talk about being addicted to television. You know, maybe you're watching one show after another, or just a silly, mindless movie. Not that there's not great stuff on TV, because there is. But just these occasions where we're just kind of mesmerized and lost in it all, right? And then somehow either the show's over or you have the wherewithal to click the remote to turn it off, you know? That moment. It's very telling, you know, and it's, I don't know anybody who doesn't at that moment go, ah. I just wasted 2 hours of my life, you know, that awful feeling, yeah? Yeah. So that's what he's pointing to. See the other show, oh, delicious. But then it stops, and see the disadvantages to really let that moment in, to feel it, to actually experience what that's like. And this is tricky because it has to be done with the highest degree of equanimity that you can muster. You can't judge it. You can't decide that you're an awful person for having done it, been lost. You just have to like sit there and go, you know, just to really let the feeling of it penetrate. That's where all the action is. It's in the direct experience of what it's like to be caught up and what it's like to be free. And I actually like to play with that moment right there a lot. I do this a lot in my own practice where I've just snapped out of it. But the residue of what it's like to have been mesmerized is still very, it's like a phantom in the mind. It's still very there, you know. And you can go back and forth a little bit between these two. Just hold it for a few moments and go, it was like, let's do it. Just notice it. Let play with it a little. Let the experience of this penetrate, because this is what Ajahn Chah is getting at. See the advantages, see the disadvantages. You got to feel the disadvantages of having been caught up in the way that we can be. Yeah. So he says, as we train ourselves to see the disadvantages as well as the advantage, that then the mind becomes a lot more balanced. You start to have some sense of strength and power in the mind and a capacity to be in the presence of different things and not be so pulled in one way or another. You know, that's what that practice of noticing both is affecting over time. And you feel the consequences of being caught up and basically we're weakening that tendency over time. And, you know, don't take my word for it. Look and see. And I'll bet those of you who've been at it for a long time will attest to this. It's definitely, it's almost measurable how that tendency will weaken over the months and years of practice. And what we're doing is actually unhinging the emotional attachment that we have to whatever the state might be, the pattern or habit of mind. And having done so, then we're really beginning to get some sense of what the Buddha is pointing to. He's pointing to this experience of non-attachment, and it's delicious. It's wonderful, you know. But the mind, Ajahn Chah would say, the mind has to get a taste of freedom. It has to get a taste for it, And so we have to be in the experience as on as a without comment about it, and with some semblance of non-attachment to be able to get that taste of it. So the Buddha said that seeing all of this was a startling discovery on the night of his enlightenment. And I think that's interesting to put it in that way, that he, if we take his word for it, he was like us at the beginning of that process, and he's pointing to something that he saw and that we can see as well. So I mean, I take a lot of encouragement from that. You know, it's pointing to not only how important it is to see it, because this was a process of clinging and release that constitutes the awakening. And he was very clear that it's accessible, that we can do it as well. So I don't know, I take heart from that, you know, that he was certainly right about an awful lot of things. Why wouldn't he have been right about this? And you know, we have to have a tremendous amount of faith and patience in the process. But I get uplifted and renewed and restored by this constant reflection on, I can do this. I can do this. I can see this. I can understand this. It's not beyond my capabilities. So one of the things that I get asked a lot about as a Dhamma teacher is why does it take so long? You know, this process of waking up to attachment and non-attachment, why does it take so long to see? And certainly there's a lot of reasons. I come down, I mean, I know there's a lot of teachings out there that say sort of promise an instantaneous awakening in one form or another, but personally I haven't seen that to be true, either myself or people I hang with, you know, that there seems to be a very organic, natural process that we all go through as we wake up. But it does take some time. And one of the reasons why it takes that time is that we just aren't calm and attentive enough. I mean, it's the basics of meditation, the first thing you learn on the first day of your first meditation retreat, to relax and pay attention. And what that's pointing to is key players in this process. If you're like me, it takes years to understand what these experiences even are, let alone to develop some mastery at resting in a relaxed state and an attentive state. And I think we have to say that, you know. You know, you get a lot of ideas about meditation quite early on, and then try to make the mind become relaxed and attentive. And yet the experience of actually being relaxed and knowing what's happening can totally escape us, because a lot of it's all getting filtered through the sense of self who thinks it's doing it all, you know. But the experience of relaxed awareness is to be researched. What is this? Yeah. But you can consider, just realize that it would be a key player in the process of learning how to be in life as it is and in a non-attached way. You know, one has to settle down out of all the impulses of our habits and patterns, our karmic patterns, and be able to look at those. Can you feel that? I mean, that's a huge amount of objectivity going on here. That just to be able to be mindful and concentrated, you see the dilemma. These things are all tangled up together. It's like you got to be non-attached to be mindful and concentrated, and you got to be mindful and concentrated to be non-attached. You know, it's all kind of working in there together. So the system has to discover for itself what it means to be here and to know what's happening. And I don't know about you, but honestly, I'd have to say I'm still working on it. You know, and certainly you get your moments. We certainly have our good days and bad days with that, but it's critical. So, you know, this is why the Buddha is emphasizing this so much. You know, just to relax, and know what's happening. And without this kind of calm and awareness, it's very difficult to see the body and mind with any semblance of non-attachment. You know, the reason is that we aren't standing back enough from experience to be able to see it clearly. It's tricky. It's very tricky stuff. And one of the things that I think ends up being a real snag for us in this process is that you know, as you begin to wake up, as we begin to get some sense of what's being said in these teachings, then and be able to stand back just a little bit from what's going on with the body and mind and be able to look at it, right? Just as we're beginning to do that, you go through this period that can go on for probably lifetimes, I don't know. But it's like where one is awake enough to be able to see the harm from the craving and the clinging. You know, you're awake, you're getting that. I mean, if we went around the room, everybody gets that, you know. We know what's being said here, right? But there's this limbo or this period where we're not awake enough to stop doing it. And that is a period that, or an experience that it's very important that we acknowledge and make some peace with it. Because if we believe what Pema Chodron says, she says, you're going to be there for a long time. So get used to it. And I point this out because it's... It has its own reward if you can make peace with it, because it's like it's humbling. It's like, I can see this, I understand, and I can't make myself do it. Yeah, that phase in there, it can go on, as I said, for a very long time, and it's very painful. But what one has to be able to do is to greet that with some semblance of humility and patience and faith in the process. This is a process that we're in. You don't get awake just by demanding that you be awake. You know, it's a process, and so this is the way it plays out. And I have found that right there, just to making peace with that, to be so rich. It's like, you know, you get patient with yourself. You get kind towards yourself. It's like, I'm doing it again. I'm caught in it again. It's like, yeah. What are you going to do? You're going to hate it? Is that going to help? Yeah? You just have to find a way to know that this is the way it plays out. This is part of the process. And actually, it points to the last point I wanted to make, which is that, you know, one of the difficulties that I've seen is, and why it takes so long, I think, is an unbelievable propensity. I think it's just a Western thing. I don't know. Maybe it's not. Some of you traveled more in Asia. Maybe you can tell us. But there's a highly conditioned tendency when we see ourselves caught in difficult states or in clinging of one form or another to do what I call turning it back on ourselves. And it's like, and the way that plays out is like, what's wrong with me? Why do I want more cheesecake? you know, or what's wrong with me? Why can't I stop thinking these vicious thoughts about that person? Or what's wrong with me? Why can't, you know, that kind of thing. And it turns it back on itself, and then just in a way, if you can feel what's being done with that kind of response, it's digging the hole even deeper. You know, because now we have a new way of clinging. Now we can cling to the way that we are clinging. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, it gets very, very tangled up. And, you know, we just get caught in this kind of self-flagellation and just spin out and go bonkers with it, with what's going on with our experience. And this has to be seen. For one thing, it only gets us deeper in. It's like that experience of being caught in quicksand or maybe stuck on flypaper or something. The more you struggle, the more you fight and resist, the more you are guaranteed to have whatever form of clinging you're in return. You know, that reaction, that resistance to the way that we are, the way that things are, is just digging a hole even deeper. And really, for another thing, you might notice that the mind doesn't respond well to being smacked around anyway. You know? It's like, you know, you've probably seen The Inner Tyrant. It's like, it's just, you know, we go back. We're so filled with this kind of self-loathing and self-hatred, and it just, you know, the energy of this is so intense and so hurtful and harmful, but, you know, which is enough in itself, but the reality is that it doesn't work anyway. You know, the mind does not respond well to tyranny. It just doesn't. When did you ever said, I'm going to be a certain way and been that way, you know, with a finger snap? It doesn't happen like that, you know. So we really have to see this and understand the process of waking up for ourselves. So the upshot of the whole teaching on attachment at this level is to just try to position ourselves in relation to the body and mind with some semblance of objectivity. That's what the Four Foundations of Mindfulness is trying to do. That's what the meditation practice is all about, whether we realize it or not. We're trying to be able to see the body, see sensations, see feelings, see thoughts as objects, as things that the mind knows and is aware of. And from that more impartial posture, then you're able to see how things are being played out. And literally, I think we have to ask ourselves that as we practice, what actually occurs in the clinging to sense pleasures? How is it happening? Literally, how is it happening? And in any given moment, and sometimes you're always going to come in on the end of it, and all you can do is retrace your steps. Sometimes you're going to come in on the middle of it, and you'll actually see it happening as it's happening. Sometimes you'll actually be able to feel the impulses. And this is what one of the major insights that the Buddha points to, is the ability to see the eye that sees the things that it sees, and this. And this, that movement of the mind that grabs hold of sensory experience is the fetter that we're pointing to here, the difficult state that we're trying to get a handle on. And so, you know, there's a powerful pull towards objects, and you can watch the mind just fondle and grab hold of an image, an idea, a sensory experience, a taste, a flavor, whatever, and watch it do it, and see all that's going on around all of that. Because what's happening in those moments is there is a promise of happiness, of some kind of happiness, and it's not that it's not there. There is happiness in sensory experience. There's no question about that. But we want to be able to see what happens if you don't go with that. Well, what's that like? You know, do you have options? some people don't even realize they have options. You know, what is that experience like? So, yes, it involves a certain amount of pleasure, but it also involves a certain amount of pain with the grabbing. And this is what we want to see. We want to be awakened to the advantages and the disadvantages so that this mind can figure out for itself what the Buddha figured out. And again, that is not beyond the capability of anybody in this room. It's powerful stuff. So I offer this for your reflection tonight as a start on the topic, and we'll pick up on some more next week. But we have a little bit of time. If somebody has some comments or questions about this process. Oh, yeah. Yes,
Adesha Napier, so another teacher, she would call it, or I heard her say this, I thought it was really right on, saying that you have to develop, it's a tolerance to be with what it is. Mm. I mean, it's that difficult to be quiet, it's that difficult to be that stable. It's like, you can't do it. You know, you have to, that's what, you know, just going back to what you were saying is how long it takes. So she put it in that.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah,
that's
great.
You got to tolerate, you got to be able to tolerate.
Yeah, yeah, thank you.
That's my experience of it too.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. One of the monks says that, and I think this is pretty apt. He says that practice is about 10% doing, and about 90% being done on. And that's just sort of enduring the karmic patterns and habits that constitute your particular variety. And in that tolerating, enduring, then the mind, in its observing, will sort it out. I mean, basically, what has to happen is the mind has to observe. It collect. It's constant in meditation. It's collecting data, and it will gather enough data till at some point it figures it out. And it decides, it determines essentially where it wants to be. You want to be here, you want to be there. Interesting. Yeah, please.
You mentioned the five senses, taste, hearing, etc. And then you said the sixth sense is the mind. And then you described it as thinking and feeling. But I have a little difficulty, a little challenge putting that in context, because it seems to me that the mind is the object, the receiver of the other senses. So how could the receiver be, you know, also the source of the sense? I can't.
Yeah, included in the mind is the capacity to know what's happening. And the interesting feature, which is, it's a great question, because the interesting feature of this mind, this human mind, is that it has the capacity to know itself. And so there is thinking and feeling, but there is also knowing thinking and feeling. It's like, wow. So it's all right in there, you know, the mind. And this, you know, if you ever want something to contemplate as a something to really feel good about, having been born as a human being, you know, it's we are born with this capacity, which to me is a setup for freedom if you just know how to use it.
Can I have a follow up?
Yeah, please.
And I think it goes to the final session. If there is that part of the mind that's knowing, that's thinking and feeling, then I tend to associate that part with the self, which there is no self. So now I'm lost.
We'll get to that. That'll come in 3 weeks. But certainly, it feels like there's somebody who's doing that. Mm-hmm. And maybe the short answer is, there is a knowing, but nobody knows. And you can rest in that. That's, again, just to be seen. Okay, so again, thank you very much. And we'll look for you next week where we'll talk about attachment to the practices.